What can we do to avoid another scenario of Iraq and Afghanistan where we send troops without an actual declaration of war? I'm joined with Ryan from Between the Liars in this episode of Blueprint. I'm your host, Ken Drew, and this is Taboo Topic.
Keep up to date with the latest content through social media. Type in the search bars of Instagram, Getter, Truth Social, and TikTok, mainly those first three of Instagram, Getter, and Truth Social, Kenjin underscore Express, I repeat, Kenjin underscore Express, spell the word engine, then put the letter K in front of the word engine, then you get Kenjin, one word, underscore Express. You can also follow this show on Facebook just by typing in the search bar of Taboo Topic. Look for the logo that says honesty equals understanding. You can listen to this show on any platform from Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google, and even Amazon, which, by the way, please don't forget to give this show a rating and review. If it's anything less than a 5-star, let me know so I can better serve you. Last but not least, you can find the inspirations for the Wednesday's episodes on my Substack newsletters. Type in the URL at kenjin296.substack.com if you want a visual of the inspiration and you want that script to see what will the episode on Wednesday shall be focused on. Share this with your friends and family members, because here on this show, we dare to think out loud and question the narrative. Free speech triumphs safe space, because in order for us to think, we have to risk being offensive. If we want true peace in our society, we have to be able to be honest with each other, without judgment. If we can be honest with each other, then we can achieve real peace in our society. Amen. This is a reminder that the Biden administration abandoned 9,000 to 15,000 Americans in Afghanistan. Now, you won't hear about this from the media or any politician for that matter, because the global elite have their own agenda that disregards human life and basic human dignity. So, to the families and individuals that have been affected by this abandonment, know that you have not forgotten. Most Americans, like myself, know, or your loved ones, didn't choose to stay behind. If there's any way I can further help besides bring awareness, reach out at Kenjin underscore Express. I repeat, Kenjin underscore Express on Instagram. Spell the word engine, put the letter K in front of the word engine, then you get Kenjin, one word, underscore Express, if you have by one in a millionth chance hear this message. It's not much, but know this, justice will be served for those who lied to justify their incompetence. After all, I believe in God, who is in control of all things, and he says, vengeance is mine. Now, let's get back to the show.
Welcome, folks. Welcome to another edition of Blueprint. I am the host of Taboo Topic, Ken Drew, with my friend Ryan from Between the Liars. Ryan, how are you, sir?
I am doing great. How about yourself, Ken?
You sure? You say you were feeling burnt out just a moment ago.
No. I said that the importance of setting boundaries so that you don't get there. I'm not burnt out yet. Although the the dissertation has been a bit of a weight on my shoulders. But I did get a draft off to my advisor this past week, so that is off my plate for now. It's fortunate and unfortunate that she's so quick on feedback, because, like, man, I just got that out of here, and now it's back in my inbox with all the corrections that I have to do. But I do appreciate timely feedback, and that is difficult to find an advisor, which, for the record, is why I chose her. So
it's still a good week is what you're saying.
It's still a good week. My students had speeches. I feel like, you know, that's they give like 7 speeches in this class. It's so many. But I brought to class this. I usually have them at this desk, but I don't. I brought them to campus. It's like a little gargoyle, but like stress ball. And he's a stress monster. And so I brought him to class, and I had all my students get in a big circle. And I said, this is the stress monster, and they came up with the name Albert for him. So we decided this is Albert the stress monster. You pass him around, you know, you get rid of all, you squeeze out all the energy and, you know, bad juju you got going on in this speech, and that's, you know, it's your lucky monster. So he's become the class mascot. So aww. I did that. They seem to like that, you know, something to, because, like, man, they're stressed, and I get it. But, you know, I got to find a way to get them through these speeches. So I'm trying to make it as fun as possible.
That's good. Now, what university do you teach? Is it Murray State by any chance?
Yep, that's correct. Murray State.
I was going to say, shout out to Murray State for following the Kenshin Express. just got a notification on Instagram about an hour ago. It's like, you got to do a follower. It's like, yeah. Murray State.
Oh, that's the Speech and Debate Union. Now, not to burst your bubble, I am the admin of that page. But, you know, I was like, you know who I'm going to follow? I'm going to follow Ken. Not the university page, just the speech
and debate team. Not the entire university, just the actual debate team itself. The
debate team, yep.
Since we've kind of, I guess, I was going to say, so Blueprint has kind of become like a little, a somewhat like poor man's version of Between the Liars and the Debate format to an extent.
And I think it's shifted that way as we've gone along, because you and I have had instances where we agree a lot, and I think we agreed more at the beginning. And then there have been instances of negotiation, and it has shifted. And we've also hit timelines, right? Like we're like, hey, let's try to keep it under an hour. But you know, if it goes over, it goes over. So shorter, more digestible. A little bit more edited. We tend to iron out kinks and stuff before we go live, but
yeah, and that's not something in my nature for my show anyway. We just go raw, dirty, blunt, no editing in between.
Yeah. You get a little bit of that though in this show, and that stretched me outside my comfort zone. So it's a nice balance. I feel like we've taken the best of both worlds here, and we've just kind of combined them for a Frankenstein makes it sound bad, but you know, like we've kind of like made like this hodgepodge of strengths and weaknesses by co-hosting.
Yeah, I guess. It's not, I wouldn't call it a weakness for, I mean, there's, for people who like that format on your show, they can go to your show. For those who like my format of the show, like the fly on the wall, as you call it.
Oh, I just meant the flaws of the host. I didn't mean the format.
Oh, the flaws of the host.
I just meant that, you know.
Perfect. Not perfect.
Well,
right.
All right. Well, Ken deals with my flaws as a podcaster behind the scenes.
I'm messing. Wright has helped me sound more educated, more scholarly anyway. So
there's
more
something
academic.
You said about being relatable, though. I mean, you know, it's a nice balance of the two.
Yeah. Anywho. So let's go ahead and transition from how our week was to actually a couple weeks ago. We actually pre-recorded 2 weeks ago. Last time we pre-recorded, the episode that came out Friday was actually pre-recorded from a Saturday the week before. So this is actually the first time Ryan and I have actually recorded since then.
Yeah.
So do you have your notes with you as far as giving our audience a recap of what we went over last week?
Right here in my mind now.
The
last episode we transitioned to the executive branch, and we've been laying out kind of our preferences. We talked a lot about the strengths and weaknesses of the executive branch, more weaknesses than anything else, to be honest. Our biggest gripe collectively being joined by AK from the Black Democrat, Black Republican podcast. It was a great discussion. I think that we reached a consensus at the beginning of the show before getting into our proposed solutions that we pretty much elect a monarch of sorts, a figurehead that tends to solve problems or what the party thinks are problems of the person in power through executive action, right? Which is why Congress is not doing their job passing legislation. So we look to the executive or the judicial branch to do that for us. That was our big gripe. And we crafted a lot of thoughts on how to create a check on that. But also, I think, Ken, it was you who had your biggest gripe or concern, at least, would be the ping pong back and forth, right? And so from that, I think we adopted a variation of all of the things you laid out in your Substack newsletter, and we'll link that below so people can check it out if they want the readable version of that, instead of the audio or the live. But in short, what we did was the biggest change we made to the executive orders was we created an impeachment process through the people instead of waiting for Congress to do that. So if the president chooses to act like a dictator and do something that is clearly in violation of the Constitution outside their powers, as Joe Biden has done, and because and that's not just, you know, people who disagree with that, it's the courts have struck things down. We've created a system whereby a president who is found in violation of a constitution, so they infringe on the Constitution with their executive orders, just like the senators, it goes to a potential recall or an impeachment, whatever you want to call it, that will go to the people. And if I know that we also talked about a convention of states, I'm trying to remember if that was because of a strike down or they could do that anyway.
So yeah, so I was going to get into that for a second. It was in case we had like a liberal Supreme Court, for example, and they said, they could go ahead and do with it. Yep. If the states can still kind of create like a another version of convention of states, right. It was like a convention of recall kind of.
That's right.
They would have to get three-fourths of all the states, or 38 states, would have to say we want a recall.
Yes, which is an overwhelming majority. It is virtually impossible to have happen by design. Not only the founding fathers, we've adopted that into this. And in case you're just joining us, Ken just said liberal court. That doesn't mean not Republican, Democrat. It means justices that tend to go with the ends justify the means rather than a true traditionalist, historically grounded interpretation of the Constitution. You have liberal and conservative there, not the same as the parties, although they do tend to align. But I did want to clarify that just in case we're like, oh, Ryan and Ken just don't like Democrat opinion. And that's not what it is at all.
Liberal justices also, they view the Constitution as a living document. You'll hear that a lot from them as well. Yes. Versus like a conservative justice, they'll view the Constitution, they'll try to read it as like its original intentions. And so you'll hear the term like originalist typically. So the real, more appropriate term, I guess you could say, is originalist versus living document justices. Yep. So,
and
your context.
Also, to be clear, the conservative justices believe in conserving the Constitution as a foundational document, not to say that it can't be changed. They just think that that needs to be done through a constitutional amendment, not by an interpretation. Especially as we would see recently, not to get too back off down that trail, but Roe v. Wade, right? It was an interpretation that was overturned instead of an actual law that they could have gone back to. So we wanted to make sure that the president was not taking the approach of either, Joe Biden recently, which is, well, I'm going to do it anyway. I'm admitting to you that it's unconstitutional, that I do not have the vested power to do these things. But by the time it gets to the courts, I've gotten my way. Right. We saw this with the moratorium on evictions. We saw this with student loan forgiveness. There is no power for the executive branch to do this. They're just choosing to do it. So we wanted a consequence that would prevent the president from becoming a dictator. Right. And if you want to talk about human rights violations, well, FDR violated a lot of human rights through executive order, and the Supreme Court didn't strike that down. And even if they had, there still would have been a time where these individuals would have been sent to internment camps anyway, American citizens, no less, right? Not just people who had similar skin color, but had actually been born or naturalized in the United States, similar to, the Japanese was the big one in that case, right? Because we had just been attacked in Pearl Harbor. So we want to make sure that there's much of a check on wild overreaches of executive power or even violations of constitutional rights or human rights. Right. So that was our big thought process there. In addition to the states being able to call something, they can't label it as unconstitutional, but they can recall the president, if you will, and remove him or her.
And currently there's nothing like that right now, currently.
Right.
So it essentially would create a sense of consciousness into not just the president, but also like the Congress as well, based on what we've talked about Congress. As far as like, they have to walk a fine line to ensure whatever they do, they have to walk within the boundaries of the law and the Constitution itself.
A lot of this podcast's driving force is the government should fear the people. It should not be the other way around. And I think that a lot of people who are opposed to those types of, the Constitution doesn't need to outline every law. Some of them can just be laws, right? Just because it's not a constitutional right doesn't mean it's not a right that can be put in through law. It's just different. I think that a lot of people's objections to these types of proposals might stem from this idea that, if the government doesn't have the power to do something, then that just means that there's going to be chaos or anarchy. It's like, well, no, the government is not supposed to dictate your entire life for all people. There's supposed to be, protections that it provides for things like human life and for core foundational beliefs. But like, just because healthcare is not in the Constitution doesn't mean we can't craft legislation about it, right? Like, and I think that that's the key here, that when we're dialing back the presidential executive powers, it doesn't mean we can't have those things done. It's just that, at least from Ken and I's perspective, we generally tend to believe that the president should not be doing these things. It should be Congress. It should be hard to pass these things, and that the nature of these tasks being difficult to pass or amend or remove from office should be difficult and should not be a bare majority, 50 plus the vice president tie-breaking vote. And that's where this comes from. But I think the last thing that one of the last big changes we had proposed was when a president passes a executive order, Ken's guidelines for that was it can only add ways to activate a law. It cannot create a new law that has not been debated. It cannot create a law that the president just wants from their agenda. It needs to be something that is being clarified through the, like, and it would be more like, I tell Ken, hey, Ken, you know, I want you to bring me a coffee. I didn't specify what type of coffee. I didn't specify what type of mug. Ken, as the president, in this case, me being Congress, could decide, all right, I'm going to bring him, you know, this nice little mug right here. And I'm going to put, you know, a half a cup of creamer in there. That's how much, like, he's specifying the details. That's the president's job through executive order. It is not for Ken to say, yeah, Ryan, guess what? You're going to drink, you know, sewage.
Coca-Cola.
I'm going with sewage because I think that better accurately represents a lot of these executive orders. But that should be the clarification process. It should not be something new. And Ken, AK and I both really liked that. The thing that I think AK and I had kind of brought to tailor some of these was that an executive order will go away. So when Trump leaves office, Biden leaves office, et cetera, those executive orders go away. Now, the president has the option to renew those, new president does, but otherwise they just go away and they can go back to the status quo. However, Congress has a specific period, I think we said 6 months, and then they are required to vote on something on whether or not it becomes an amendment to the law or whether it just stays as this executive order. So after 6 months, if Congress, they have to call a special session or at least put it on their docket to vote for this.
Right.
And they decide, is this a new interpretation of the law? If yes, then that is now the default. So it's not going to go away when the president leaves office. It would actually need to be rewritten by Congress later if they want that changed. However, if they decide, no, we want to, you know, leave some error, et cetera, you know, whatever the reasoning here, then the executive order just remains the interpretation until the president leaves.
More or less.
Yes, more or less. And I think that was the big things we got, unless I missed anything, Ken.
So what I have here, I think you brought it up already. If not, I'll bring it up real quickly. It's like the nature of an executive order can also be used to enforce explicit constitutional matters in Supreme Court rulings.
Yep.
For example, I refer back to Brown versus Board of Education back in the 50s and everything like that, where the governor of Alabama at the time was denying and saying, telling the Supreme Court to go kick rocks, essentially. And Eisenhower said, the hell you are. So he sent the National Guard in over there to enforce a Supreme Court ruling so that a president could still do things like that. And let's say a state, for example, is violating a constitutional right. And let's say New York, for example, let's say Trump sees New York and they're denying the right to assemble freely in the church like they did during the pandemic. If President Trump wanted to, he could send the National Guard in there and say, listen, it's the Bill of Rights. You do not have the right to go ahead and deny people's basic rights based that's outlined Bill of Rights. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think just to kind of really hammer home the clarification process here, Trump could not pass an executive order or just decide, you know, like, hey, like, this is what we want to do just because that's on my agenda. It has to be something that is in violation. Another right. example of this might be the sanctuary cities, right? So sanctuary cities are actually in violation of federal code. The president would then have the prerogative to make sure that those who are here illegally, that the cities are claiming, well, we're just going to choose to not do this. In theory, the president would have the ability to bring down federal law because of the supremacy clause, right? If it is explicit powers given to the federal government, we're allowing the federal executive branch to enforce those. Same can be true for marijuana, right? So at the federal level, there's a law that says marijuana is illegal. States that just happen to say, well, we want it legal here. Technically, even in today's society, if the federal government really wanted to make that a fight for them, they could start sending federal agents to start enforcing that law. Now, there is a social repercussions. They're like, that's just not going to be a good look, right? You pick and choose your battles, right? It's like parents with their kids, they have to decide. I would imagine that granting amnesty or just, you know, releasing, like what we've seen most recently in the news, is not just these states being like, well, we'll house them, but it's like, no, come here and then we'll just send you to the states that, you know, are our political rivals. In that case, in these examples, it has explicitly and solely been blue states who have claimed to be sanctuary cities or sanctuary states, and then they send them to red states. And Joe Biden has even been sending, you know, immigrants from blue states and shipping them to Florida and such. So that would actually be a violation, right? Because federal law does not, Biden cannot just decide, well, we're going to, you know, not prosecute these. Not only that, we're going to ship them elsewhere. So right. I just want to make sure that we clarify that the president can't do what Biden is doing right now. But now that I think about it, we didn't really set up a penalty for that. We set up a penalty if they pass a law, or excuse me, if they sign an executive order But what about in an instance where like Biden is choosing to not enforce borders and he's chipping them elsewhere? Do we want a similar impeachment process that goes to the states?
I'm down for that. I mean, at this, but at the same time, though, like the tricky thing is like, what would initiate that exactly? Would it just be a 3/4 of the states again, or do you want to do like a simple majority for that one?
Is 2/3 of the states for the?
Excuse me, 3/4. Excuse me, 38 states. Do you want to do super majority 3/4, or do you want to do simple majority?
I would do the same rules as what we did for calling the convention of states. So 2/3 have to call the convention, 3/4 have to ratify. So you need the super majority in order to impeach the president for this offense, but you need 2/3 of the states to call it, because okay. That way we're not getting, you know, this is part of the reason that impeaching of the president has become political, because you don't need as many, right? And when you maintain control, and I want it to be very difficult, but I also want it to be a check. So really, I think that the supermajority 3/4 would be the way to do that, just because it ensures that there is actually an egregious violation that many states agree upon, not just a few states that happen to get in line.
That makes sense. So we want to apply that then when we come back to the Supreme Court ruling, like 2/3 have to at least, it only takes 2/3 to recall or initiate a recall, and then 3/4 to actually have the full recall occur.
Yeah. So we call a special session, a special convention of the states, and then those based off of if 2/3 of the states do it, every state has to vote.
Gotcha.
And then the only question would be, is that based off the delegates of those states, so state senators and state representatives, or is it like a true democracy, like every person goes and votes?
I mean, we can revert back to the electoral college system.
Okay, so then it's going to be the state delegates then.
State delegates, yeah. We'll do state delegates in recognition that we're a republic and now a true democracy.
Okay, I like that. Good. Was there anything else we missed? I can't think of anything. I want to say we hit them all.
No, but based on last week's conversation, it does give us a good springboard into this week's conversation concerning the commander-in-chief. At least for me, I've seen pretty much, at least actually both of our lives, they're basically the same age. Like, we've seen the president increase its power as far as like sending troops in at will.
Yep.
And that's one of those things where the founding fathers didn't want to happen. And that's why the original parameters. So let's go ahead and get into the historical aspect real quick. So technically in the Constitution, a president himself cannot just declare war. It has to be declared war by Congress. Same process, 2/3 of the Senate has to approve with a simple majority in the House. And then it gets into the president's hand to sign it. And then boom, declaration of war. That's happened 11 times in our nation's history. The last time though was World War II. So I want people to keep that in perspective. It's not impossible for Congress to declare war. It's not like that was like a one-time deal. It's happened 10 other times in U.S. history.
You said World War II. What about Iraq, Afghanistan?
And that was not a declaration of war.
We didn't actually – oh, Congress never declared it.
Never declared war. Nope.
Yeah, that's news to me. Good. The more you know.
Yep. No, there was never declared war. So, and one of the parameters that allowed us – it has allowed us to send troops, at least the president anyway, allowed to send troops without a full declaration of war was the Security Act of 1947, which is a pretense, which in theory, any executive action that entailed putting boots on the ground would be within reason. After all, it's an enforcement of the law. So President Bush, for example, his father, George H.W. Bush, he sent troops to Iraq for the Gulf War under the premise of the National Security Act of 1947. And same thing with George W. Bush. As a matter of fact, George W. Bush even expanded that after the attacks of 9/11 and created the TSA. That's where you have like some of these three-letter mafias that came into play as a result, really, from the National Security Act. The National Security Act was basically the springboard for the commander-in-chief to increase their power, essentially. It's kind of wild to think about it. It created the Patriot Act, and that's where you had like the NSA, for example, the state of surveillance, right? And so, again, in theory, the president's not doing anything illegal technically, because it's technically an enforcement of an already existing law based that was passed back in 1947. And we can argue whether or not that's the root cause that we should address, as far as like that needs to be repealed by Congress, or there should be a constitutional amendment to ensure Congress and the president can't just continue doing stuff like this. But the part of the issue that I have, Ryan, when it comes to this, is it should be hard for the president to send troops, period. Even let's say we get attacked and everything like that, that should be the responsibility of Congress, as we've been discussing since we started this edition, right? This limited edition blueprint. We want Congress to do their damn job. But lately, they have been able to do their job because the president's power has increased so much that at this point, like we've talked about last week, it's become an elective monarch. It's become an elective king. So they can bypass, and you can have George W. Bush, or the last Bush, that sent troops to Afghanistan and Iraq without an actual declaration of war made by Congress. And a lot of people have strong resentments concerning how George Bush sent troops to Afghanistan and Iraq. Iraq was more, the resentment was stronger and a lot sooner than Afghanistan. Afghanistan has only been more recent resentment. But it shows you like how the American people genuinely feel about the roles of the commander-in-chief. They should not just be able to send troops overseas and fight them, you know, fight foreigners, if you will, to fight wars that the American people don't approve of. And based on the premise we've already set up, as far as like we repeal the 17th Amendment and everything like that, these amendments I have proposed here would essentially like create another check for the president, and it would actually kind of give back more, it would give power back to the people too. So here are my proposed amendments. And again, you and I can debate whether or not it's the National Security Act that's the root cause we need to repeal it, or we just need a straight up constitutional amendment to prevent anything like the National Security Act again, which that's what I would argue, but that's just me. But under no circumstances, point one, under no circumstances shall the president of the United States have the power to send the regulated militia into foreign land unless there is a declaration of war established by Congress. Second point, the president shall have the power to readily prepare for war on domestic ground. So only on U.S. soil they can prepare for war kind of deal. And abroad with established bases. So we have a base, for example, in Qatar. But they can only do so with the approval of Congress here. And they can, and foreign entities. So they can't just create a base at Qatar or invade Iraq again. Let's say Iraq again, and establish a base there and prepare for war at that moment. Like they have to get the consent of the Iraqi government, which kind of falls in line with the president's role as far as like the power to negotiate treaties and everything like that. It kind of really reinforces that aspect of the executive power. So any new military installation must be negotiated with the foreign leader, and then get the approval of Congress in the same manner the president would in case of a treaty. Then the last point I have as far as an amendment, constitutional amendment, to limit the powers to avoid a scenario like Iraq and Afghanistan or any war that we fought. Even the Korean War was never a declaration of war by Congress, which is kind of wild to think about. The president shall not have the power to establish cabinets that violate the Bill of Rights. The president shall not, under any circumstance, use the regulated militia or federal agency against an American citizen. And those are my three big points that I want to change in the Constitution to limit the powers of the president.
Let's talk about that last one. I just want a little bit of clarity. Can you read that one more time about not the president not having the powers to activate against American citizens?
Yes. So the president shall not have the power to establish cabinets that violate the Bill of Rights. So like, for example, Biden tried to create the misinformation or disinformation board earlier this year.
And Obama created the nuclear czar or like the climate czar or something
right.
like that.
Or Bush created the NSA or the TSA. The president shall not under any circumstance use the regulated militia or federal agency against an American citizen like Biden did when it came to after January 6th, Biden got the National Guard up there and basically intimidated the American people to even try to protest Inauguration Day. And you can make the argument like, well, that was justified. You know, there were security threats. But let's be honest. the majority of the people there were there peacefully protesting on January 6th. And we don't want the people to be intimidated to even peacefully assemble and protest against their own government, if that makes sense.
So if the president cannot send agents against a U.S. citizen, when U.S. citizens commit crimes whereby they need to be brought to justice, who would you think that should fall back to? Does that fall back to like the FBI, states. The CIA? Okay.
Just to get back to the states, let them handle it.
Okay, so then is this basically nuking the FBI then? Like, is it completely neutering their power to do things federally at that point then?
Yes.
Okay. And I know we're going to have a whole segment about pretty much every one of the three letter agencies here. So the FBI is supposed to deal with and work jointly, and they do work jointly with state agencies. Right. Like in many instances, the FBI actually needs to be, actually, I think it's all instances. The FBI pretty much has to be invited to work alongside these agencies. They can't just like take over. Now they get to choose what their prerogatives are and things like that. So, for example, the FBI, you're going to see a lot with like harm towards children. Right. Like with paraphernalia, things like that. Right. Like if you have those types of violations on your computer, obviously the FBI can get involved. Is that going to, since that's not directed by the president, but the president does have some say in like who's appointed to the FBI and stuff, are you removing all indirect abilities to do things as well? Or like the president can't say to the FBI director, you need to go do this
like,
or that.
To avoid a scenario like Trump, for example, where Biden approved the FBI to raid his home, for example, like the FBI, it would have to actually be, as you said, invited by the states first and foremost to investigate this event. So before the FBI even raided Donald Trump's home in Mar-a-Lago, it would have to go through DeSantis first.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does. I think that you have the possibility there. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just, you know, thinking through all the possible scenarios. You do have the potential scenario where, you know, how Democrats have cities, blue cities, that are sanctuary cities for immigrants, shielding them from being exported by the federal government. You might see that potentially. You might have the ability to see people at the state level shielding people who are in their states from the federal government. Not saying that's bad, not saying that's good. I'm just saying it might happen.
But they're not American citizens either at that point.
Right. But I'm saying in this case, if I am a citizen and my state likes me, whether it be politically motivated or justified, they might shield me from that. And that might be a good thing. I'm just saying that, like, in this case, DeSantis and Trump, the accusation you would have is, well, the colluding, right? DeSantis is protecting Trump. They're in the same party, yada, yada, yada. Now, whether it's justified or not becomes relevant. It's just something that can and probably would happen and cut both ways. Are we good with that? That's what I want to know.
As long as it's a matter of a constitutional right, for example. Yeah. So it can't be the FBI can come in there because Trump said some mean things or someone said some unpopular opinions about January 6th, for example, like they've been doing, like they've been raiding American citizens' homes, for example, because they were there January 6th. They were just simply there and they were inside the building. They took no room for nuance as far as like, well, they let them inside the building, for example. So this would avoid a scenario like that, where as long the FBI cannot go in there with a Bill of Rights, essentially, an issue of Bill of Rights. Does that make sense?
It does. So there, and as long as we're allowing provisions for people who need to be prosecuted because of violations of higher laws, like, so for example,
like murder,
you right. But like what I'm going to say is one example of this is you have the right to being protected from unreasonable search and seizures from agents, right? Even police at the local level. Unless you've committed a crime, they have the evidence for that crime, right? Then a judge can execute a warrant on your place, right? So like as long as we still have those types of protections that are not politically motivated or are not, you know, hey, I need to sign a warrant to get more evidence, etc. Like as long as, you know, we have a process for that, I'm okay with what you've provided there because it protects citizens. In fact, you know, I mean, Josh says something about this, which is like he would rather you know, 100 guilty people go free than one innocent person be incarcerated. And you're almost creating that type of a protection, is that you've made it more difficult for the government to just rain down on American citizens at any level. Right. And I'm not, I'm certainly not saying that's a bad thing. It's just with the way you frame that, as long as we're good with that. And off the top of my head, I'm okay with that. So long as there are legitimate ways when we can demonstrate X is a violation, we've agreed that this supersedes your right to privacy, etc., then you have the ability to be arrested and brought in. Because like, the, what I don't want is being like, well, a person can never be arrested because they're an American citizen. And so as long as we hammer out that nuance, I know that's not what you're wanting. And I don't want that. So we're in agreement there.
Yeah. Then, I mean, this would essentially, this would still nuke the power of the FBI and CIA. Right. Quite a bit.
Which
and
a lot of those were supposed to be temporary anyway, so yeah.
And not only that, but they would, the FBI and CIA, like I said a moment ago, I mean, not having said a moment ago, but like, they can, let's use the USA Gymnastics situation with the US team, women's team they had to go through with that sexual assault cases and everything like that. The FBI would still have jurisdiction over that because that's a national, you know, international situation that affected American citizens, and it was like an actual crime that occurred. But let's say again, someone said something, unpopular opinions about January 6th, about the election results, the FBI can't just go raid their homes just because, again, they feel they can't just have a broad interpretation of what's a threat based on freedom of speech, Second Amendments, like the NFT, what is it called again? Is it NFT?
NSA?
Not the NSA, the one that has the, oh, AFT.
ATF.
ATF, sorry. ATF, thank you.
Right checker. Letters, wrong order.
Yep. Sorry. You know, they can't just raid those people's individuals' homes just because, again, that is the explicit right in the Constitution. They can't just go ahead and raid those homes. You know what I mean?
Well, same for, I mean, this would even extend to parents at school board meetings. You can't have the FBI literally fabricating letters, requesting letters and saying, hey, well, if you write a letter, you know, Merrick Garland effectively saying, yeah, well, if you write a letter saying you feel threatened, then, you know, we can. We don't need any evidence at that point. Like that's that, and it allows them to operationalize against U.S. citizens without due process.
And it would still be in alignment with the amendments I made last episode, as far as like when it comes to constitutional matters explicit in the Bill of Rights, the president could still write an executive order and enforce to ensure that people's rights are being protected at that point.
Right. Or even I would even go so far as Supreme Court interpretations of these laws could also be executively enforced. I'd be open to that.
Right.
Because so, for example, there are free speech is pretty absolute in the as the First Amendment of the Constitution.
Right.
But we have certain restrictions in order to balance humans' rights in all instances that have been leveled out by the Supreme Court. And the president operationalizing government agents like the FBI to enforce those protections, I would be okay with so long as it is a clear violation of the Constitution. Or a clear violation of what has been established of the Supreme Court ruling. Yes. So I'd be okay there. What you can't, and here's the thing, there are people who make threats who need to be taken out by the FBI. They, and by taken out, I mean just removed, you know, like as far, not like kill them, but like remove them. I'm just trying to be clear. I don't want this to be twisted. They need to be able to be arrested by the FBI, not Mafia Hit Squad. They need to be able to, but then also go through the due process. And that can be protected so long as there's clear guidelines. What you can't have is people saying, well, I don't feel safe because someone expressed a contradictory opinion. Like there needs to be an explicit threat that is made, not people showing up dissenting, if that makes sense. So that as long as the constitutional precedents and interpretations that have been laid out or the Constitution or explicit laws passed by Congress are violated, then I'm okay with that. And I think that, you know, it's not to say that I think that some of these things are problematic, right? Like if, it, you know, there are speeches that I disagree with strongly, but I am so convinced that those are the speeches that need to be protected, right? Unpopular speeches are the ones that need to be protected because no one's, if I say, you know, I love cupcakes, people might disagree with me, but that's not It's not dangerous speech. It doesn't need to be protected because no one's going to try and take that away from me. It is the things we vehemently disagree with that need that protection. And I'm so convinced of that, that I'm willing to say that the federal government should not have the ability to willy-nilly just go in there, especially on minimal grounds. So anyway, all this to be said, I like the three or four points that you brought up, because, and it's not to say that I don't think that some of these things should be cracked down on or handled in specific instances. I just don't think the federal government or the executive always needs to be doing that, right? You can start with local authorities dealing with an issue. Like if there's an issue at the school board, doesn't mean you need to send the FBI after these people.
Right.
Necessarily. Right. I mean, if it's,
if it's one of those situations where the local law enforcement feels that they can't continue on with this, or they have to request state assistance, and let's say the state can't handle it, then at that point, if the state wants that extra help, then they can go ahead and request a federal agency and get that enforcement of the law.
Yeah. And I think that required asking for assistance, right? Because states do that all the time. And we're even seeing that recently. We're like, you know, we've even seen a couple of blue sanctuary cities be like, yo, President Biden, we can't handle the 50 migrants. So, you know, we need you to send the National Guard, right? Like, I think. So just to go back and comment on your section or the point that you had made about the president, you know, declaring war, sending troops, et cetera, I think that we need to crack down on a president's ability to get around through these loopholes, sending off American citizens. There are times and places to do it and times and places they shouldn't. And Obama not sending out troops, but choosing to bomb the hell out of Yemen and Libya, you know, these other countries, I think that's questionable at best, because you have the ability for a country to potentially come in and declare war on us for those types of things. Right. So do you want to add
extra parameter then, as far as like,
I'm thinking that might be worth at least discussing, because the president, you know, I think there are instances where they need to act quickly and they need the ability to do so. You mentioned the exception of if there's an invasion on U.S. soil, best exception I could think of right there. We need to act. We need to act immediately. We don't need to, you know, get Congress to go through and declare war and all that. Like, that's almost the self-defense clause of, you know, the exception to you cannot kill someone, right? Because the exception there is in self-defense, we value your ability to protect your life.
Right. So it could be, yeah, I could see. I don't think I actually had that provision in there. I don't think I thought of that nuance perspective, that extra point as far as what if there's an invasion happening right then and there. We don't have time for Congress to declare war at that moment in that situation. Right. We need action right then and there. We need to respond. So I can make an exception for that. I guess my provisions prevent us from just playing offense. Yep. But there has to be an actual justifiable cause for us to play offense, or it's just really a response at that point. So in reality, the only time we can, the president, other than an invasion, the president cannot send troops or even attack another nation without the approval of Congress first.
And I am not an isolationist. I don't think that the United States need to completely withdraw. I think that there are...
And that's why I have that provision still, as far as like if the president still can prepare on other bases around the world.
Right. As long as they're invited.
Yeah, as long as they're invited.
That's the key, right? Because imperialism is where you come in. You're like, well, we're going to be here anyway, whether you want us to be or not. But when they're welcomed, I think that we should have the ability to do that, because there is something to be said. As much as I think there are legitimate gripes for extending ourselves out as much as we have into a lot of these other nations, when the United States is the top dog globally, it deters people who will do harm against other smaller, weaker nations. I'm not worried about someone attacking the U.S. I mean, I am, but I'm not. Like, it's not as clear of a threat as, let's say, you know, there are Russia, China, North Korea. These are countries that if there is not a deterrent of some type, it doesn't have to be the U.S., but a deterrent of some type, then you don't have a safeguard against these nations. And I think that there is a balance. Now, I'm not saying that justifies the U.S. going out, but I think that what you had mentioned is, hey, if the president is wanting to form treaties with these countries and say, hey, you know, how about we put a base on your country, you put a base, you know, somewhere else, whatever the agreement happens to be. and it's voluntary and it's collaborative, I think that there's nothing necessarily inherently wrong with that. So I like that provision that you gave.
And not only that, let's say the other nation does invite them, but the people, for example, like the majority of the Americans, do not want Congress. They don't want us. They don't want to get ourselves involved in this. Like Ukraine, for example, Ukraine would love to have us there, but the majority of Americans don't want us involved with Ukraine.
Yep.
Then at that point, we have to go back to Congress, and Congress has to approve. And based on their provision, as far as like we removed the 17th Amendment at this point.
Yep.
So in theory, the 17th Amendment is supposed to be an indirect voice of the people. Mm-hmm. So at that point, the people have a voice again, as far as like, okay, well, the president and the Ukrainian president agreed to establish a base, establish U.S. presence there, but our people and everything like that, they don't want us to establish a base in Ukraine, so we're not going to vote in favor of this. And so Congress is like that final check to ensure the president, again, can't just send troops whenever they want, or they can just establish a base whenever they want. It goes back to the power of Congress at the end of the day.
So maybe I misunderstood. We have a base in Germany, let's say, right? Because we do. The U.S. has a military base in Germany. Let's say we didn't, right? But the president was like, you know, it'd be strategic for us to have a base there. We're not in any conflict there. It'd be good, you know, a centralized location. Let's just put a base there. Is that something the president can do, or does Congress have to approve that?
Congress has to approve that at the end of the day.
Okay. So the only thing the president could do now in this new world is to respond in self-defense immediately,
yep,
executively, if the U.S. There's is attacked,
correct,
it is invaded. And what about if there are, well, let's just give the example of in Afghanistan, right? We had a base there, we were evacuating it, and it got attacked. Because we already had a base there, let's assume Congress had approved to put that there. Can the president, through executive order, send out more troops if there's like a siege and then they need immediate help? Or does that have to go through Congress? Because that's not a declaration of war, but we are being attacked.
That's still technically U.S. soil at that point. We have American citizens of being affected at that point.
So you will allow for that. I'm not saying that's an exception, but you're allowing that to be because we have people there and they were already agreed by Congress, presumably at this point now, to be there. Okay. What do you want to do with all the places that we currently have? Do they need to be approved by Congress, or do they sit?
We can grandfather them in at this point.
Right. I like that.
So any base that's already established, just grandfather them in. They don't have to go through the process of Congress to reestablish everything. But they could just be grandfathered in, and any new base from here on then has to be approved by Congress at the end of the day.
Right. Do we want to provide some kind of like an emergency provision so that Congress doesn't have to vote on like every drone strike and everything else we do? Like, could they draw up legislation that says the president has the executive authority to send whatever drone strikes, et cetera, that is needed for this time period in this area? So let's say President Obama could have been given executive authority to, you know, strategically choose when and where to do those drone strikes, because it is technically now going to be falling under a needed declaration of war beforehand. Can Congress delegate that, but with specific parameters?
No, I don't think they should.
Okay. So if the president wants a drone strike, he pretty much has to say, I want these 5 drone strikes over these times, and Congress has to approve them.
Yep.
Okay. Under our idea of a single resolution bill, do those all have to be individual, or could we group them as a single item saying that?
I think we agreed as far as like it has to be the issue itself, and then they can actually, and the budget aspect has to be included as well, right, in there as well.
Sure. Okay. All right.
Because since when he sent drones to, I think, Syria, it was, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, that's to them, that could be easily a declaration of war. And then that gives them a justification to come and attack us. And then, well, congratulations, we just started a war that we didn't really want to begin with. The American people didn't want anyway, just because Obama, again, or just any president, I should say, any president just wanted to go ahead and act on behalf of everyone else without the approval of the American people first, at least.
What about President Trump sending the drone strike that took out, I think it was the Iranian terrorist leader, or I forget which country, but it was, everyone was convinced that Iran was going to declare war on the United States? Would something like that, being a drone strike that is also time sensitive because of the intel, is that something that needs to be declared, signed off on by Congress?
I think it should.
Okay. So the president ultimately makes the decision. What do we want to do to make sure that Congress gets their butt in action and decides to do it or not? Like they vote on it.
Well, I mean, we could give the president the power to call a session to Congress, an emergency session, if you want.
I like
we
that.
We can give that parameter. We can give that power to the president as far as like, hey, listen, there's an issue of national security that must happen that we need to decide on immediately. Okay. And so the president can unilaterally call a session of Congress without like the House Speaker or the Senate Majority Leader. Like they all have to come to session at that point. And unless, you know, they're either dying or on their deathbed, they have to show up.
How do you deal with the top secret nature of these issues? Because something like that, it was not designed to have people know. You know what I mean? And like, and it's not only time sensitive, it's also strategic that no one knows that we know, because then he's just going to move again. So what do we do about that then?
So we can just say that, whatchamacallit, I think the president can declare a special session.
Okay.
And they can have a closed door meeting and everything like that. So if anything, the media, they can assume like it's a matter of national security that's being discussed in there at that point, and that that's being voted on at that point.
Okay.
And so, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say there is there are levels to security clearances, right? And so if you work in the FBI, CIA, et cetera, like staff, you have to have certain levels of clearance. And not all Congress has the clearance, which means they're not eligible to know all intel. So I think that's my concern here.
I was going to say, so this going to require Congress to all have security clearance then at that point.
Okay. And then if you're going to – and I don't – like the possibility that something like that could get out, you know, botch it, etc. So then what I would say is I would prefer that Congress have the ability. So like with Obama taking out Osama bin Laden and making that call, what I would say is Congress can declare a target to be a viable
target. Okay, so let me backtrack real quick. Okay, hold on. Let me retract some things real quick. So, like, let's say Osama bin Laden, the mastermind behind 9/11, he would not have to get, because he was the mastermind and attacked U.S. citizens on U.S. soil, the mastermind, the president does not have to go through Congress. It would still be under that exception as far as, like, when we're being under attack. Mm. You know what I mean?
So then, I do. And I don't disagree with you. Now, the inconsistency that I'm seeing here, though, is the terrorists that Trump took out was basically on par with Osama bin Laden, right? So he had done things to Americans, et cetera, and committed those violations.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Okay. So then let me put it this way. If we want to maintain that Congress has to declare these things, then we could say, like, all right, they know anyone we can link to X terrorist organization, right, can be taken out, let's say, and they could have a standing order, etc. So for example, back when Bush had declared, you know, we're going after Osama bin Laden, and it took us, you know, basically like four terms of presidencies to find him, there could be a standing order that when we find him, you have permission to take him out. It doesn't matter who it is, etc. The president can execute that as needed without having to disclose that information to Congress. Doesn't have to be voted on. It's already been voted on. Right. All and right. Then they can also say it doesn't matter where they go, like none of that. Same for like if we're in a conflict with some of the, you know, Iranian terrorist leaders.
All right.
Trump could have had a standing order that said you find X, Y, Z person, anyone in that area who works with them or with ISIS or whatever. Then you have permission, regardless of where they're at or even in these select countries, to take them out. And that would prevent an order on every single one. But as far as what we discussed earlier about everything needs to be approved every single time, maybe we could say that, you know, you can make groups of enemies based off of the violations, like you had mentioned, the exception here is an attack on Americans in American soil or American bases worldwide, etc.
Right.
What do you think about that?
I look at that parameter or that nuance, because at that point, I mean, like you said a moment ago, we don't have to worry about, because it's a matter of national security and anything like that. We don't want the bad guys or the enemy to know what we're about to do. Since they're like, let's say the president does call for a special session or anything like that, then the enemy can say, okay, well, something's going on. What are they discussing? Now, granted, they would still have like there's a sense of elements of surprise because they don't know what's about to happen, but they know it's something's going to happen so they can prepare for the worst kind of deal. And we want to avoid a scenario where they have time to prepare to avoid accountability.
Okay. Agreed, 100%. And I know that there are provisions for like leaking security things, etc. But I'm thinking of the AOCs of the world who put a lot of political issues on blast on their social medias.
All right.
I'm assuming there is a provision for a government official who violates the top secret clearance there that they're removed. But I would make that, if it's not already the case, then this person would be forever barred from engaging in any political office, any branch at any level, just permabarred, just completely permabanned. And I don't care what type of leak it is. Their social media is talk to the press, you know.
So do you want to make it? So do you want to make it to where even doesn't even have to go for like a formal recall? They can just be booted
just
out.
Done. Yeah, and it's and it should be required that that happen. That now proven that there is a leak and that they did right. So AOC goes on live stream and is like, oh yeah, so you know we just had this session. I disagree with this. I voted against it. Blah blah blah. Boom, and you know like and I'm not. Yeah. What I don't want is for it to become a political game of like, oh, well, you know, X person might have said this, but like, you know, just clear violations like that.
Yeah.
Just boom, done. And I'm assuming there is a provision for that already. I just want to make sure that if there's not, that there would be.
Well, we can add that provision because I don't think I added that provision. So
other than that, I agree with, I'm fine with the provisions you made. Sounds good to me. I like that we're holding the executive branch a little bit more accountable now. And it's not to say that I think that, you know, the executive branch shouldn't have these powers. I just think they need to be checked. This is about restoring checks and balances because the president, as vaguely as the executive office's duties and other things have been left, I think there needs to be some nuance and some open to interpretation, right? Like we don't need to micromanage everything. But right. With these violations, as we've seen, I think that there is a need now to rein in the things that are becoming problematic. And I think that being able to send American citizens to fight wars that were not approved or supported, or send funds and things that were not supported or approved, then, you know, this needs to be a huge, huge check. Same for, you know, it's important that we keep the single item issues, right? Because what I don't want is Democrats or Republicans to take, oh, you're on a time threat? You know, like what I'm going to do is you're either going to give me everything I want on this non-related thing, or it's a you are for this or against it. You will be on record as for or against it.
Right.
And it will be released when it is appropriate to do so for that transparency, because we've talked about the roll call where every politician is required to vote and be on record. And I think that this will not be an exception. It might not be released until after, you know, these things have happened, but you should know what your politician is voting for.
So do you want to make a provision then as far as like once the president, once this action is actually taken to effect and it's actually practiced, like let's say we take out Osama bin Laden.
Yep.
Do you want to make it to where like within a week of actually taking place, the public records has to be released as far as like this is how Congress voted for the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. And even with Osama bin Laden, that instance could literally just be we voted for this. Now you can know because it's not like in a.
Osama bin Laden is a bad example because, again, that would fall under 16, the parameter.
20 years.
That's fair. I mean, at the same time, though, like Afghanistan at one point, it's not to go off too off track and everything, that Afghanistan did offer Osama bin Laden to Bush like early on in the Afghanistan war. So it sounded like we couldn't get him then. Could have easily ended a lot sooner, but that's a whole nother tangent.
So sticking then to the executive powers, I think that, yes, there should be, to answer your question, yes, there should be within a certain amount of time. Week is fine. It needs to be released and it needs to go out.
I'm down with that.
Okay. What else did we have on our agenda to discuss about the federal? Are we wrapping up the federal branch today? Is that
no, not today. Okay. No, we got one more week, folks. We got the presidential pardon to discuss, because that's also been an issue that's been brought up, especially more so with President Trump, because, you know, the establishment media, you know, they hated Trump and all that, but that's a different tangent. But we're going to talk about the presidential pardon. It's been a point of controversy. Excuse me, I can't speak English, but it's been a point of controversy really since the beginning of time with the United States. So next week, folks, tune in for the presidential pardon. Also, really quickly, let me give a quick shout out to my friend Devin Farley for the track that he produced in the beginning of the show. Thank you so much. We'll eventually get it in the ticker. We promise you, we'll get it in the ticker. So make sure you hit the like button, hit the share button, and the subscribe button. Help our self-esteem by hitting that notification bell as well. We don't get paid to do this. We do this for fun as a hobby. So by all means, hit the notification bell so you know when an episode of Blueprint is coming up, because you want a visual of what it means to have a smaller government as a conservative. And if you're a liberal, you want to know what it means when conservatives talk about smaller government. At least with Ryan now, you know what we think should be a smaller government.
It's true.
All right, Ryan.
You want me to take it out?
Take it away.
All right. Remember, you can find us on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, Twitch, and Google Podcasts. Please do follow us on our social medias at Between the Liars and at Kenjin _ Express. We've got them all. So check them out. Make sure you follow us there so you know when we are doing our shows and what to expect. And if you do enjoy the show, we would greatly appreciate it if you took the time to give us a 5-star review and share us with your friends. Subscribe to our channels. We do have one each YouTube channel. So help us envision a smaller, better, more accountable government. And that starts with the blueprint. Bye for now.